Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the broadcast. I'm Tracy McClure, and I'll be with you over the next half hour. Coming up today, Pope Francis wants us to be active instruments of mercy. We take a look at what he had to say at the general audience and at a Jubilee Mass for prisoners. And putting mercy into action. We find out how one young American and a group of volunteers are doing just that. Well, we begin today with a look at the general audience of November 9th, when Pope Francis urged the faithful not to fall into indifference, but to become active instruments of mercy. Linda Bordoni was there and tells us more.
Addressing the crowd gathered in St. Peter's Square for the weekly general audience, at a time when the Holy Year of Mercy is coming to an end, he reflected on the corporal work of mercy that calls us to visit the sick and the imprisoned. Recalling the many readings in the scriptures that tell of how, during his life, Jesus incessantly reached out to the other, Pope Francis said, "He is our model as we consider the corporal works of mercy that call on us to visit the sick and the imprisoned. Sick persons," he said, "often feel very alone, and something as simple as a smile, the warm touch of a hand, and a little company can prove to be excellent medicine." And he praised those who visit the sick in hospitals, saying their contribution is of inestimable value.
È un'opera di volontariato impagabile.
When this kind of work is carried out in the name of the Lord, he explained, it also becomes an eloquent and effective expression of mercy. Let us not deprive sick persons from obtaining comfort, or ourselves from being enriched by closeness to he who suffers. Likewise, the Pope continued, visiting the imprisoned is a fruitful way of bringing the Lord's healing presence to those who are paying for their mistakes. As Christians, the Pope said, we are called upon to bring God's mercy and its redemptive power to our brothers and sisters in need. He also spoke of how he has a special place in his heart for prisoners and recalled that Jesus himself, though innocent, suffered in prison for our sake.
Il Signore è stato sottoposto. Catturato, trascinato.
Finally, thinking back to last Sunday's Jubilee of Prisoners and to his meeting with a group of inmates who told him they wanted to go on to share St. Paul's experience with other prisoners, the Pope pointed out that we can all be instruments of God's mercy, with a gesture, a word, or a simple visit, which, he said, have the power to give back joy and dignity to he or she whose joy and dignity have been taken away. I'm Linda Bordoni.
In St. Peter's Basilica the previous Sunday, Pope Francis celebrated a special Mass for the Jubilee for prisoners. In his homily, he reminded prison detainees to never lose hope or to fall into the temptation that they can never be forgiven. Around 1,000 detainees from 12 countries took part in the weekend celebrations, along with their families, prison chaplains, and staff, and various associations. The Jubilee for Prisoners was one of the final major events of the Jubilee of Mercy, which will come to an end on November 20th. Anne Schneibel brings us this report.
Francis centered his homily for Mass for the Jubilee of Prisoners on the theme of hope as it appears in the day's readings. For instance, there are these seven brothers from the second book of Maccabees who speak about the hope of being raised again by God. And then in the Gospel, Jesus' response to the Sadducees that God is not the God of the dead, but of the living.
La speranza è dono di Dio.
Hope is a gift of God and should be nourished, the Pope said. Whenever someone makes a mistake, he said, the Father's mercy is all the more present, awakening repentance, forgiveness, reconciliation, and peace. The Pope acknowledged that the loss of freedom experienced by detainees is the worst part of serving time for one's crimes. However, he urged those in prison to maintain the breath of hope.
L'Apostolo Paolo parla di Dio come del Dio della speranza.
the Holy Father turned to the day's reading from the letter to the Romans, in which Paul almost seems to tell us that God too hopes. His mercy gives him no rest. He is like the father in the parable who keeps hoping for the return of his son who has fallen by the wayside. If God hopes, then no one should lose hope, the Pope said, for hope is the strength to keep moving forward. It is the power to press on towards the future and a changed life. It is the incentive to look to tomorrow so that the love we have known for all our failings can show us a new path.
A volte una certa ipocrisia spinge a vedere in voi.
Pope Francis spoke of the hypocrisy of those who see prisoners only as wrongdoers and who disregard the possibility of rehabilitation. Going off script from his prepared homily, the Pope said how every time he enters a prison, he asks himself, why them and not I? All of us have the possibility of making mistakes. The Holy Father reminded those in prison to not be held captive by their past mistakes and never yield to the temptation of thinking we cannot be forgiven.
Quante volte la forza della fede ha permesso di pronunciare la parola perdono.
Pope Francis turned his reflection to the importance of forgiveness among those who have experienced violence or abuse against themselves or their loved ones. Acknowledging that there are some wounds that only God can heal, the Pope said that, nonetheless, when violence is met with forgiveness, even the hearts of those who have done wrong can be conquered by the love that triumphs over every form of evil. In this way, among the victims and among those who wronged them, God raises up true witnesses and workers of mercy.
Che la raffigura come madre che tiene tra le braccia Gesù con una catena spezzata.
Pope Francis concluded his reflection by turning to the statue of Our Lady of Mercy, protectress of prisoners, an image of Mary with the child Jesus who is holding a set of chains. May she intercede for you so that your hearts can experience the power of hope for a new life, one worthy of being lived in complete freedom and in service to your neighbor. I'm Anne Schneibel.
The Vatican Secretary of State, Cardinal Pietro Parolin, says he hopes the newly elected American President, Donald Trump, will be guided by God to serve his country, but also to promote peace and well-being in the world. Philippa Hitchin tells us more.
Talking to journalists on the sidelines of a conference at Rome's Lateran University, the cardinal said he respected the will of the American people as expressed in this exercise of democracy. We send our congratulations to the new president, he continued, in the hope that his government may bear real fruit. Cardinal Parolin said it would be premature to comment on specific issues such as immigration, noting that the views of presidential candidates often differ from their policies once they become president, and adding that Trump had already spoken in leadership style. He said Trump can be assured of our prayers that the Lord may enlighten and support him in the service of his country, but also in the service of well-being and peace in the world. Cardinal Parolin concluded by saying he believes there is a need for everyone to work to change the situation in the world today, which is one of grave wounds and serious conflicts. I'm Philippa Hitchin.
Following the U.S. vote November 8th, the president of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, Archbishop Joseph Kurtz of Louisville, Kentucky, said elections assist a country in seeking the common good, and he expressed his hopes for the Trump presidency. He spoke to Christopher Wells.
Archbishop Kurtz, thank you for speaking with us this morning after the American elections, not just for president, but for a lot of offices and initiatives throughout the country. I know the U.S. bishops have been very involved in the political affairs of the country in the sense of praying and supporting our nation. Can you tell us, Archbishop, about how the USCCB and how the American bishops, the American church, reacts in the days following a very big and momentous election?
Well, first of all, as we all know, for Catholics, for people of goodwill, for people of faith, an election is very, very important because it assists a country, a nation, in seeking within their own area the common good, the good of the human person, a good that respects the dignity of every person. Last year, Pope Francis, of course, came to the United States, and both in Congress at the White House and then in Philadelphia at the World Meeting of Families, he reiterated how important is engagement and involvement in the political process. So while, of course, we do not endorse specific candidates, we seek the common good, and we bring to bear our Catholic social teaching and the principles that that mark a direction that promotes the common good. So now that the election is completed, we are, of course, eager to be able to welcome our new president and all the new elected officials, so that we'll be eager to work closely with President Trump, as well as both houses of Congress, as we seek to really promote the good of all. And our hope would be to be able to do that, as we've done now as a conference for, well, darn near 100 years.
Archbishop Kurtz, you mentioned, of course, that the Church is not in the business of endorsing particular candidates. Nonetheless, over the course of the past years and decades, the conference especially and individual bishops have spoken up and brought to people's attention different kinds of issues. What are some of the issues that are still important that we need to focus on as we welcome this new leadership and returning leadership in our country?
Well, we've done, I think, a commendable job in presenting a vision and a path forward in forming consciences for faithful citizenship. This is a document that has been issued a number of times. It has just been revised, actually about a year ago, and presented. And it gives somewhat of a direction forward. You won't be surprised to know that we begin looking at the common good by protecting the human person, human life, from the very moment of conception to the natural death. We look for opportunities for all people to be able to live fully their lives. And, of course, we have special resolve for brothers and sisters who are migrants and refugees, that we strongly believe they can be humanely welcomed without sacrificing our security. I'll mention two other issues, and one dear to us is addressing violent persecution that's threatening fellow Christians and people of other faiths throughout the world. We need to stand with them and provide ways to protect them. And then, of course, the great issues regarding a domestic religious liberty, ensuring many, many issues, not the least of which is the truth about our families, about a family based on marriage of one man and one woman. So new beginnings, but many, many issues that we will be bringing to the fore with the new administration.
And can I ask you one more question?
Sure.
In many ways, this was a very divisive election. You saw some of that in debates people had and in conversations people had throughout the country. What do you see as some of the challenges going forward after a long and hard-fought campaign?
Well, it's correct that there has been a lot of division, and it will take all of our energy, and especially calling forth the best of our leaders and the best of all the people to put aside a divisiveness of Democrat or Republican or any other political party, and really, in our view, see the face of Christ in our neighbors, especially the people who are suffering, and even those who disagree with us. I hope that the Church can be somewhat a beacon, leading that by the way we as a Church model the notion of civility, as we seek to stand with our truth, but to do so always in charity.
And do you think there's some significance to the fact that this election and this campaign took place during the Year of Mercy, which has significance around the world?
Well, of course, I'm glad that we're mentioning the Year of Mercy, which we're very, very close to completing. What a gift it has been. And we can draw on the Year of Mercy as a path forward in the way in which we look on the way we treat one another. I always say that mercy is really the love of God when it touches the heart of someone who's imperfect. That's all of us. And so in the political arena, this is especially true, that we don't sacrifice our convictions, of course, but in bringing forth our convictions, we always do so by proposing and not imposing, and by seeking to bring out the best of the person next to us. I think that's the way of not only receiving God's mercy, but sharing that mercy with our brothers and sisters.
Archbishop Kurtz, thank you very much. Do you have any final words for American Catholics, for Americans, for the rest of the world who's listening in on this conversation?
Well, I may say that every election brings an opportunity for a new beginning. Some people may right now be wondering, well, can our country come back and reconcile into a unity that we can work together and fulfill a promise of what we might call a more perfect unity? But the hope of Christ, I think, motivates people of faith to be able to join with people of goodwill and other people of faith, other voices of faith, in being able to take advantage, if you would, of this new beginning and see it as a new opportunity, a time that we might seek a falling out of violence and a rising of civility in our public discourse.
Archbishop Kurtz, thank you very, very much.
As the Year of Mercy draws to a close, November 20th, I want now to put the focus on how some young people are putting mercy into action. Just as we heard Pope Francis say at the beginning of this program, is something we should all aim to do. The Italian NGO Missione MVC, or Christian Life Movement, has been taking an international group of young people to Peru during the summer over the past 10 years to build schools and houses for poor families living with little more than a tin roof over their heads. Teenagers and young adults donate their time and hard work to those truly in need. In Peru, they spend time volunteering with children at orphanages and caring for the elderly and disabled. Garrett Johnson is one of the young men studying for the priesthood who organizes the missions. He told me that for some young volunteers, the trip can be life-changing.
The idea of the Christian Life Movement, which is a movement that was originally founded in Peru, was to go back to the basics of Christian life. And a lot of that has to do with building community and amongst friendship. So that's kind of at the heart of it. It's a very simple idea of trying to be Christians. Looking around the world, and especially kind of in the world of the youth, which is kind of one of the focuses, is that I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what the Christian life is all about. And I recognize that for all of us, many times it's difficult to understand what exactly we're looking for, Christ is calling us to do. What we decided to do was to invite the youth in an adventure. And especially here in Europe, there's kind of a disenchantment, a disappointment with what they see. I see a lot of antibodies when it comes to ideals, principles, to trying to live something that's great and big and important and thinking that they can really change the world. The change that we bring to the world might be small, it's authentic and it's real. And I think we're trying to invite them to say, give this a shot. Let's try to live a great life and something that's actually going to be worth living. With the mission trips, we decided to invite Italian youth. And here in Europe, there is poverty, but I would say we're talking about a completely different level of poverty in Peru. People who spend all the days working the fields and they receive just a few dollars in payment, and they're worried about where they're going to get their next meal continually, how to feed their children, a real lack of opportunities. They don't have housing. When it rains, their children get sick, their clothes are wet because they are usually putting together shacks. I mean, finding some way to get by day by day.
Paint us a picture of what does it look like in these villages where you go? You actually rebuild people's homes.
It's pretty shocking, to be honest. The first time that you get there, you basically arrive and there's a desert area. All the water, the drinkable water, and the water they use for cooking is brought in by trucks. A lot of these people come from the highlands. They don't have a very good education. Even some of the grandparents or some of the older members still speak Quechua, which is a native language that goes back to the Incan times. For them, it's very difficult to fit in with the society in Lima, which has a different culture. It's a city. So many of them will have to kind of drive a few hours to get a job, or they'll maybe just work around in the area doing some kind of farming work. And what you see there is the ones that first arrived from the highlands, and that could be because they were looking for jobs. It was because also in the 80s and 90s, there was serious terrorism. So a lot of people were running because they were being killed or threatened. So they had to leave their homes, leave everything they knew, move to this desert area just to get by. You see their housing, they just grabbed whatever they could find. Everything's kind of just dirty. The mothers try to do their best to cook something that's tasty for their children, but a lot of times their children will have maybe one meal a day, sometimes two. They do have a school there, which is good. The education isn't great, but it's something. There's a lot of dogs and cats that are just kind of walking around because evidently there's no control. You'll see that the ones that have gotten there first many times have been able to start building homes maybe made out of brick. The ones that got there last will usually end up on the top of the hill, and there's no stairs many times. And sometimes when we've gone, we've built stairs just so that they don't fall. Usually the poorest are on the top of the hill. There's even sometimes disputes. The ones that got there first will have electricity, but they won't give that electricity very easily to the ones that get there last. When we go, you want to offer material support. We're going to put together prefabricated homes because it's easier for us. And we have experience, and there are experts that come on board and help us. But it's pretty simple, the construction of it. Simple, but not easy, because this is a very tough terrain. But in addition to these kind of projects, also trying to encourage them to live out solidarity amongst themselves. The most tragic part of what they live is the feeling of being abandoned. Of forgotten. Because in addition to the terrorism, there's a lot of homes that suffered also from earthquakes. And these people, their homes that they had built were very unstable, and so a lot of them fell. And the government, in theory, helped some, but 5-10 years later, there's still a lot of people who have never been helped.
But when you bring these kids, these European kids who have a much better life over here, when you bring them over, how do the local people react?
They kind of just have their mouth open. They're not exactly sure what to say. The children are pretty excited. They're freaking out. They're jumping up and down. They want to play. They're really happy, and the joy on their faces is definitely contagious. The youth are interested, but maybe a bit more just kind of curious, but they're also a bit more hesitant because they feel more insecure. And the adults can be very warm, very welcoming, and others can be a bit even suspicious because a lot of times people from other countries have come in, and there's a long history, for example, of mining and things like that. And also people from Lima, even just color-wise, tend to be whiter. Thankfully, in the town that we've gone to the last few years, because we've gone there year after year, and they've had a very good experience, there's always kind of a foundation of trust there, even amongst the adults. Mm-hmm. So they'll invite you. And we did something new a few years ago, is before we started the actual construction, we brought the youth in to meet the families. So just to hang out, get to know each other, try to get to know the names of the children, hear a bit their stories. And those kind of first eye-to-eye contacts, we're saying, you're a person, I'm a person. There's a lot of difference, but we have some awesome things in common, is really important.
And what do these trips mean to the young people who are coming from Europe? And do you see any kind of transformation in these young people? They leave from Rome, they leave from Switzerland or England or wherever, and they go to Peru, and then they come back here. Do you see some sort of change happening?
Each youth is a world in him or herself. When they go, it's curious because we're pretty clear that this is not vacations. This is not a tourist trip. You're going to work. You're going to work hard. You're going to be tired. You're going to be uncomfortable. In addition to the manual labor, we have conferences. There's moments of prayer as well. And after these conferences, there's also small groups. So we have talks with them at the end of every evening. So this is long, intense days, and the intensity is both physical and interior. And when you see them get there, it's curious. The first few days, they're usually kind of in shock a little bit, especially when they kind of start to witness for themselves the conditions that these people live in. But it's curious, after a few days, they maybe start pulling out their cell phones a bit more, retreating a bit back into their own world, and in some way kind of trying to run away from the situation because they're not exactly sure how to handle it. None of us are sure how to handle this, especially the first time. And every time I go, I find myself doing the same thing. Throughout the trip, what we try to do, and I think something that kind of distinguishes what we do with Misione Imebuchi, is to ask a lot of questions and invite them, in addition to an exterior journey, to do an interior journey and say, what is it that I'm living? What is it that I'm seeing? We're not always capable to digest it. So we try to help them. That kind of interior journey, I think, is what, in the end, for them, one of the most important aspects of the trip. And afterwards, when they get back, again, it depends on each young man or young woman. There are certain cases where I've seen significant change in their lifestyle, understanding their own wealth or their own commodities, or how they understand the planning of their life, whether they're just going to use all their efforts to get a good career and make a lot of money and that's it, and kind of live a pleasure-filled life. And they really start to question that. Others, it's a bit more subtle, the change. And I think they get back and sometimes they kind of go back to their own ways. But the interesting thing is that because we've been able to kind of develop a friendship too, is we try to keep in contact, you know, and just to remind them, and this group will send photos and there's a video that we do at the end. I think we plant a seed. Undoubtedly, there's a seed in every one of them that is planted in this experience. And we try to help them when they get back to continue to kind of cultivate that? Because it's very difficult to go back to your high school, go back to a university environment, and really change, and really allow this to change your life, because it could imply renouncing or sacrificing certain things. I would say by the friendship that continues after the trip, and the amount of youth with which we still have contact, and they still look for us, and every time we send a picture, we have groups on WhatsApp or on Facebook, and every time you send a picture of something from that year, they just explode, and you say, man, that was one of the best years of my life. For me, there's no doubt that there's a change, and that in some way their hearts have been touched, their eyes have been opened. We all pray that they have the courage and the hunger to respond to that beauty and that kind of love, and a different kind of beauty that they saw, whether it be in their own acts of charity, or whether it be in the lives and simplicity, and a different kind of beauty that they can see in the lives of these Peruvian families.
Now, Garrett, you are from Texas. Many of the kids who are here in Europe who go on your programs, they speak English, they speak Spanish, Italian. I can imagine that this could be something of interest in the States.
We actually do have a variety of things that we've done from the United States, of groups, other members of the Christian Life Movement who are in the United States. I couldn't get to your number, but we have a lot of missions coming into Peru. There's a program called Bridges, which is bringing in quite a few groups of high school groups to Peru. There's another one called Creatio, which was a bit more focused on ecological matters and kind of respecting God's creation. But the Christian Life Movement is very active there. And the mission trips, I think, again, is one of the most powerful kind of experiences that we have to offer. I couldn't give you a number, but I know there's a lot of groups that are passing through Lima or through other countries in Latin America where we're present.
Okay. I think that's fantastic. Do you ever think about going home?
I do. I go back to the United States to visit my family once a year. So usually after the mission trips, I will come back, and if I can, I'll go directly there. But every now and then, some of us have to accompany the group on the flight back. Otherwise, they cause ruckus on the plane. So we come back to Rome, and then usually a few days later, I will take a trip to the United States.
I don't know why I didn't mention it before, but my son went on one of your programs a few years ago. He was really touched because one of the things that you guys organized was also, they spent a week, I think it was in Lima, and they worked with mentally challenged people in a home, elderly people, and then they also worked with young kids. And,
orphan.
And he found that really moving and quite special, and especially taking one little old lady out in a wheelchair to see Lima in the middle of the day. And I think that was a lasting impression he'll have. He did something nice for other people. That really touched him as well.
I think that's it. I think it's just to say, look, we take you seriously, and you can change people's lives. And many times the goal or the greatest achievement that the kind of world proposes to them is a title, a career, or something like that, which are all good things, and you have to go for that as well. But I think just showing them the fact that if they get outside their comfort zones, kind of put down the cell phone for a bit, and look around them, there's so much that they can do, whether it just be kind of playing a bit with a child who doesn't have a father, or spending time just listening to them, or even if you can't speak the language, taking an old granny for a ride on the wheelchair can give her a joy, and you who do it, a joy that you could never expect.
Good luck then to you on everything, and especially on this big adventure that you've set out on. Garrett Johnson from the U.S. state of Texas with the Christian Life Movement, MVC. And that brings us up to time today. You've been listening to Vatican Radio's Vatican Weekend with me, Tracy McClure. I do hope you've enjoyed the program. Thanks for listening. Feel free to drop us a line with your comments and suggestions. We're always happy to hear from you. Our email address is english@vatiradio.va. Again, that's english@vatiradio.va. Bye-bye for now. Laudator Jesus Christus.